There are over 1 million identified species of insects and spiders in the world today, and that doesn't even include those that haven't yet been discovered or categorized. While we don't have quite that many here in Wisconsin, we certainly have enough to make sure we always have plenty to talk about when Phil Pelletieri comes by. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Phil is an entomologist and head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have you back, Phil.
Nice to be here.
It's your first visit of 2013.
Yes.
How auspicious.
We always have bugs to talk about.
We always have bugs to talk about. And I know that people love to hear from you about bugs and to ask you questions. So let me give the phone number so people can join in the conversation. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question, comment, or an insect photo on our Facebook page. And that's The Larry Mueller Show. And Mueller is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. So, Phil, let's start by talking about, I'd say, probably universally one of the least favorite insects, that is the tick. And there are some illnesses that we can get from ticks. First of all, let's describe ticks. What kind do we have in Wisconsin? What are they exactly?
Sure. Well, they're not insects. They're a group among themselves. And although there are probably close to 15, 16 species we have seen, the two that are important to people are what most of us who grew up here call a wood tick, which is technically the American dog tick, Dermacentor variabilis. And the one that has gotten our attention in my career is what we call the deer tick, or black-legged tick is the official name, or bear tick. It goes under the three common names, but to an entomologist, they are now defined as the black-legged tick. And what makes that one of such concern, it's the primary vector of at least three diseases in humans: Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, and a third organism called babesiosis. And the common thread of all of these appear to be mouse diseases. And what the tick is a bridge. When it acquires it from the mouse, and then the next time it feeds, it has a chance to transmit. Lyme disease, the tick wasn't discovered in the state until 69. Fascinating story to that. The speculation is that the Ice Age wiped them out. They had to recolonize, and we're not sure exactly when that happened. But one of the key factors, aside from the ticks coming up all the way from Texas and the like, is we needed a certain deer density to support the tick populations. And so a few things had to fall into place. So it's a relatively recent occurrence. And then, of course, somehow this organism in mice started to show up in the ticks, and then this whole thing was rolling. And there's a very similar story out east where Lyme disease was discovered in Connecticut and, you know, that whole thing. So that's been very fascinating for me to watch in my career as it has evolved and spread out of the northwest part of the state up into Spooner. And then recently this anaplasmosis was an organism that was discovered for the first time in Minnesota and up around the Superior area, and that seems to be becoming quite a bit more prevalent too. As everything in nature, it's kind of a constant evolving type of thing.
So not all of the tick species that we have here necessarily carry diseases, but of the types of ticks that you mentioned, is there a pretty good chance that if you're bitten by one of those ticks that it is carrying one of those diseases?
With Dermacentor, what's interesting is the wood tick is capable of spreading Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And is the primary vector in many other parts of the country, but we rarely see that disease. I think, you know, there's like been three or four verified cases in the last 20 years in the state. So we got the right tick, we don't have the disease. With deer ticks or black-legged ticks, it turns out the adult population now is approximately 40% are carrying the organism. Now, it takes the tick upwards of 48 hours of feeding on you to transmit. So a lot of times if you're removing ticks, that's why the big thing about if you're out in tick areas, you do a tick check, you pull them off the same day they're on your person, there really is no chance for transmission. And that's what helps us out quite a bit in cutting down the potential. But again, this change of earlier in my career, it was quite common for the infectivity levels to be closer to 1 in 5 or 20%. That has been spiking up. I will add one caveat, though, is that in 88, we saw the drought have a significant population reduction effect on deer ticks, and I expect that same thing, at least in the southern part of the state. Now, the people up north, again, had a little bit more rain, so maybe not to expect that, but some of the work that my colleague Dr. Paskowitz has been doing with tick sampling is suggesting we've already started to see tick mortality issues because it was so dry.
And the 88 drought, we were pretty close to the same conditions
this year. Yes, in fact, there's so much about that year was deja vu for me this year with as far as the kind of critters that were active, the mites and the like. But as I said, that was one of the other artifacts. It was the only time I ever really saw tick numbers go down in the state. So it'll be interesting. You know, the figures we'll get for Lyme disease cases and people will take some time to compile. Mm-hmm. But for the first time in the last 20 years, I would not be surprised at all to see a reduction because it's been a constantly growing type of problem for
us. So this might actually give us a little break. So the ticks that are transmitting these diseases, is it during a particular part of their life cycle?
Well, the interesting thing with the deer tick is that there are life stages available all the time. Now, the smallest stage that hatches from the egg, which is called the larvae, is clean. It has not fed yet, so it's had no opportunity.
Okay.
If it does feed on a mouse, and then it transforms into the nymphal stage, and then if it feeds one more time. And so the fascinating thing about tick biology, a two-year life cycle, they only feed three times. And you expect twice the number of infectivity levels in the adults because they fed twice rather than once. But there is a life stage out there anytime there's no snow on the ground. And so historically, I have seen ticks in January when we get a great warm-up and people are out walking. And so it is possible. And that's, I think, the big change, because those of us who grew up here, usually the tick season was, you know, May and June, and then Derma Center is pretty much on a major decline as far as chasing people around. But with this black-legged or deer tick, you have to keep your guard up all the time.
And that's an interesting point you just made, because I remember last winter when it was so mild that there was actually a pretty short window in the winter when people weren't seeing ticks. I remember people talking about it well into late fall, even early winter, that they're saying, is it possible I'm still seeing ticks? And then again, so early in the spring.
And although you don't want to go to absolutes, when I start talking to folks that have finding ticks in August and whatnot on their person, the chance of it being a black-legged or deer tick is probably about 98%, because that's the only thing that's out there foraging. Now, as I said, if you find ticks on animals, there are some other species. There's one associated with rabbits. There's one associated with squirrels that one could bump into. But those ticks have no interest in feeding on people, and so that's why we really don't pay much attention to them.
And those illnesses that you mentioned, Lyme disease and anaplasmosis, what is the impact on people?
Basically, the initial symptoms are very flu-like, a lot of fatigue, body aches. In the case of Lyme disease, there is a rash that's present in about 60% of the cases. What makes Lyme disease quite problematic is that there are secondary symptoms, if it's not treated, that, from what the medical people tell us, are more autoimmune-related, but arthritis and neurological complications. And you know, with those kind of things, you're not quite sure what's going on in the person. It's not so much the organism anymore as your body overreacting and all the problems that that presents. And with anaplasmosis, again, usually not the rash, but a very similar type of problem. And, you know, these things are basically verified by blood tests, where they're looking for antibodies that suggest that your body is trying to fight back. And but basically, I think the advice to give folks is if you know you've had a tick bite and you get flu-like symptoms, is to talk to your doctor very quickly, because we find that treating it right on the initial infection, we're far more successful at dealing with the organism versus when it disperses in your body and it gets more complicated.
And I wanted to let people know that on the Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show, I did put a link up for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, their page on preventing tick bites. And so you can either go to our Facebook page, that's the Larry Mueller Show, M-E-I-L-L-E-R, and go use the link to get there directly, or you can go to CDC for centersfordisease control.gov, do a search for tick bites, and there's some really helpful information there. Let's go to the phones because we have some tick-related questions here. Jane in Cross Plains. Hi, Jane.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Question for Phil. I'm a registered nurse, and this happened last fall, something I wasn't familiar with. My sister lives in Virginia. She got bit, they think, by a Lone Star tick.
Mm-hmm.
And she developed the alpha-gal reaction, so now she's a vegetarian.
Ah.
Because she can't eat any red meat.
Yes. It's not necessarily just Lone Star tick from what I know of it. And I'm not probably as up-to-date on the literature for this, but there's a complicating factor of the salivary components of ticks that apparently set people up that they start to become allergic to meat.
Wow.
If I remember right. Is that kind of your understanding of it?
That's my understanding.
Yeah,
she can still eat fish and she can eat poultry, but any kind of four-legged red or white meat, pork, lamb. She develops almost like an anaphylactic shock, too.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said, you know, in one doesn't expect that for people unless they have a sensitivity. But just to me, the scientific mystery it takes to put all those parts together is really quite amazing. Now, the Lone Star tick is more prevalent south of us, Missouri, Indiana, but we're starting to see activity in Wisconsin. And again, my colleague, Dr. Paskowitz, has been doing some work. And in fact, I went back in all my old diagnostic records of Lone Star ticks I have seen. And, you know, sometimes these ticks hitchhike on birds, so you can see how one could be brought up to Wisconsin. But the most significant thing in her work, she found nymphal stages, which suggest reproduction here. This is one of those arguments we're making of why the climate change is having all kinds of interesting effects. And, you know, I've said on the show before that the governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us as far as the way the insects right. are behaving. And this is another one of those arguments. So there's still few and far between, but we're starting to wonder with these milder winters, it's given an opportunity for that tick to extend its range northward.
Well, and just in general, with the warming of the climate, it seems like there will be more range going further north for a lot of
insects. Oh, definitely. And I've seen that in my career. And as I said, I could give you 4 hours of lectures of things that have come into the state and taken up residence that when I was a graduate student here, you had to go to central Illinois. So, yeah, there's a lot of evidence. And, of course, in other sciences, there is also, of these range extensions.
Sounds like a potential topic for an upcoming show. I think that would be really interesting, actually. And why would a reaction to this particular Lone Star tick be to be allergic to red meat? Is it something about what they're picking it up from?
Well, no. I think what it is whatever proteins and other things that they're putting in the system and your body is developing antibodies to, there must be a cross reaction here of some sort that causes that kind of response. But it was, as I said, recently published. It's not that common, but you kind of go, oh my goodness, as I said, that a tick bite could have those kind of effects down the road for somebody.
Wow, that's really interesting. Well, thank you, Jane, and good luck to your sister. Let's go to Mary in Wauwatosa next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. My son is a big hunter. Now, he has had two blood tests for the tick bite. The doctor says he does not have the Lyme disease. We are sure he has the Lyme disease because just the way he's having problems. It affected first his legs, then now his hands, and now he's getting quite sick. Did you ever hear of that? What should one do if the blood test doesn't show it?
And actually, I have to say, Mary, I have a close friend that is in the exact same situation.
Well, this is what makes Lyme disease kind of medically a very challenging disease because there's so many symptoms and there's no tests that are 100%. Although I will tell you that, you know, if we went through a series of tests and none of them went positive, the science would suggest that there's some other underlying cause, even though it looks like Lyme disease. But your body should respond and show you antibodies if and truly it is that spirochete that's causing the reaction. So as I said, I'm not a physician. This is, you know, technically a medical question.
This is
question,
from your entomology perspective.
But from the perspective of the blood tests, especially a series of blood tests and not seeing any change in the titer levels, would argue that there's something other underlying cause causing the reactions.
Okay, I will tell him that.
And Mary, did he actually see a tick on him around the time that he's...
No, because he's so much in the woods that this had to happen last year sometime.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, but I'm sure it's Lyme disease, but they're saying no, it isn't. It just, everything from what I hear and read, it sounds like it.
Sure. Well, you know, one thing people can consider in that case is getting a second opinion, in particular of dealing, if they're not comfortable with their physician, with somebody who kind of specializes. And, you know, that was one of the problems 25 years ago is nobody had any experience. But we're finding, you know, more and more, and especially with Wisconsin, with our history, is people who have had a lot of experience. And that may be something to consider.
Thanks, Mary. And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today, talking with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234, sending an email to talk@wpr.org, or posting a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Our on-air producer, Dave Potraz, will be happy to get your questions in to us. Talking about the fascinating world of insects with entomologist Phil Pelletieri today. He's with us until 12:30, so lots of time for your questions and comments. Just want to let you know that tomorrow at 11, Chad Spate of Chad's Carpentry and Chaz Vaughn of the Windows Design Center will be here to talk about ice dams, condensation, and other winter house woes. So be sure to tune in for that. And Phil, we have some other tick questions. So let's go back to the phones and Ron in Traverse City. Hi, Ron.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have questions on ticks again. Number one, I've noticed I burn wood, and when I bring wood in the winter from the wood pile, mosquitoes seem to all of a sudden be flying around the house like they're hiding under bark. I wondered if you need to worry about ticks doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And also the size of the deer ticks. I found wood ticks easily in the summer when I'm up in the Upper Peninsula. You can feel them attached to you, but I wondered if deer ticks are a lot harder to find because I'd heard they were a lot smaller.
Sure. Okay, the first question, I mean, hypothetically, you could find a tick, but I don't think it's very likely. In fact, we've had a lot of the same questions about Christmas trees. When people bring Christmas trees, would there be ticks on there? And that's just not... it seems the ticks would much rather get down in the litter and like to spend the winter and not necessarily crawling under the bark of things. So I don't think there's that much to be concerned about. Firewood's an interesting thing because I get all kinds of critters. Probably about a third of the samples that I see from homes at this time of the year are all kinds of creatures that are emerging from the firewood. You know, wood-boring beetles and ants and parasitic wasps and all kinds of things. And the good news is they're all just a nuisance. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to worry about there. Now, the size of the tick, the adult female is approximately two-thirds the size of the regular wood tick. So where they get a little bit more difficult to pick up is the immature nymphal stage is quite small. Not invisible by any means, but quite small. And it's interesting if you look at human cases and when they are most likely cured. It's the middle of the summer when it's very difficult to find an adult deer tick. What you're finding are the nymphal stages. Mm-hmm. And that probably explains, because they're a little harder to see, so they're less likely to be pulled off, which means there's a higher potential for transmission. But definitely not invisible. You know, the wound itself will remind you of somebody poking you with a pencil. Especially if an adult has gotten on you for a couple of days, you often get quite a significant bruise. I've got some great pictures in my file of my own person of ones that have attacked me on the belt line and whatnot that, as I said, you'd swear somebody just took a pen and just jabbed the devil out of me. And that's just a localized reaction to what's going on with mm-hmm. the tick. The rash that people talk about really presents sometimes as a bullseye type rash, where a very defined outer edge and a very clear center to it. But at times it also will present almost like a heat rash. And so, as typical of symptoms, they're not the same in every person. So again, we go back to, I think, the issue of you know you've had a tick bite and you start to have stiff necks, fever is the other thing. That's when it's worth talking to the physician, because, you know, one of the treatments that is used quite successfully, if you can treat somebody within the first 48 hours of exposure, they give you just one day's dose of doxycycline and you're done.
Oh, interesting.
So it's not a long-term regime. The longer you have the disease, then the more complicated the medical treatments are.
And now, Phil, just going back to the sizes that you talked about, you know, are we talking like poppy seed size, sesame seed size?
Yeah.
Is there something you can compare it to so people
have a... Well, the nymphal stage is probably the size of a small sesame seed. In fact, very reminiscent in color and shape to that. When you get the adult tick, we're getting somewhat larger. I would kind of describe it as a small apple seed.
So that's pretty good size, actually.
Yeah, definitely.
When you think about being able to spot things with the bare eye. So great. Well, thanks for that, Ron. And let's go to Randy in Madison. Hi, Randy.
Yes, good morning. Going back to a previous caller, the woman whose son thinks he has Lyme's disease, I have been dealing with a Lyme-type issue for 4.5 years, severe joint pain. Been tested for Lyme's disease 3 times now, and I've come up negative 3 times. But I spend a great, great deal of time in the woods, and I have pulled numerous ticks off. And My question is, there are numerous other tick-borne diseases out there, and isn't it possible that they keep on testing for Lyme's disease and there's something else going on, but it's also tick-related?
It has the potential. I mean, even when this anaplasmosis came about, I mean, the symptoms are different and the like, but, you know, until they got enough data to suggest that there was something else there, and I will tell you, we know that there are undescribed tick diseases in other parts of the U.S., because people are getting Lyme-like reactions, and the deer tick is not found there, and so there's got to be something else going on. So definitely, but, you know, what's difficult about the diagnosis here is if somebody could take a blood test, put it under a microscope, and see the organisms, you know, that would be the hard evidence. But even if you've got bad Lyme disease, that's not the way you test for it. There's not enough spirochetes in your blood to pick it up that way. So instead, what they're doing is, again, looking for reactions to your body to foreign chemicals, if you think of them that way. And that's the antibody test that they run. And, you know, they've gotten better over time. So, yes, there could be another organism responsible for it. And, again, the interesting thing from my understanding of the reaction of the joint problems, it's an autoimmune problem. It is an arthritis problem. It's your body overreacting. It's not like you've got the spirochetes present in your knees. And so, as I said, that's what complicates the diagnosis, is that it's there's not that hard evidence that you would hope for. To look at. So.
Well, and just to remind people that Phil is coming at this from an entomology perspective, not a medical doctor perspective. So definitely, you know, pursuing, like you said, second or even third opinions and talking to people who might be on the cutting edge of tick-borne illnesses would be the way to go. Let's take one more call on ticks, and then we are going to move ahead. So Doug in Mount Horeb, you're next. Hi.
Hi. Not to end the program turning into a medical program, but I'm also calling about the tick test and about the previous caller. And I just wanted to encourage people who have been told that they don't have Lyme disease, who have been tested once or twice, to even get a third or a fourth test. We have a family member who was tested for Lyme disease because of all the same symptoms that she reported in her previous call at the major hospital here in Madison, and they said, you don't have it. She got a second test at University Hospital. They said, you don't have it. She then, a year later, said, all these symptoms match everything I read everywhere about Lyme disease, and they reassured her that she didn't have it, but she insisted on getting a third test. They sent her out of state to a hospital that specializes in multiple forms of Lyme disease, and she had it on the third test. Mm.
So good advice for really continuing to follow
up on it. I guess
one
place to suggest to folks to go, and you know, you always got to be careful on the internet because, as we know, there's all kinds of things there that aren't science-based. But the CDC came out with, I think you would call it a white paper on Lyme disease diagnosis tests, the whole thing. And it's quite involved. I mean, 40, 50 pages. But that's where I guess I would refer people. If you really want to get in the detail, they reference a lot of scientific papers that talk about things, treatments, you name it. Mm-hmm. And as I said, that I think would be a good resource for somebody that wants to get into some depth and get some feel for it. And again, it is written by a number of physicians, a panel that studied what's the ongoing thing. And again, the tough part of it from the medical side is that the symptoms mirror so many other problems and so the overlaps and complications, but that would be a place to go.
Thanks for that call, Doug, and we will definitely get the link up to that CDC white paper on Lyme disease a little later in the show. We are talking with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. He is with the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he is happy to answer your insect questions. Are you having trouble with any particular types of insects indoors that you wish would stay out? We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Miller today. So, Phil, we touched on this a little bit, but I want to go into it in more depth with the cold and the snow outdoors. It's not surprising that there are quite a few insects that are happily setting up housekeeping right along with us indoors. What are some of the insects that folks might be encountering?
Well, the first group that we bump into is a number of insects would kind of be loosely defined as pantry pests, but they're things that are in food products, bird seed, pet food. So we've got some moths, we've got a number of beetles, and these things would happily continue to breed if you've got a bad bag of bird seed back in the closet. So that's always one of the first things to look for. Secondly is, again, items brought in. We had mentioned the firewood. There's all kinds of neat creatures in firewood, and because of the warmth of the house, they think it's spring already, and so they will come up. And so especially if you see some rather large beetles with long antennae and whatnot, in fact, even might remind you of a cockroach, those are often wood-related creatures. And the good news about them is that they're not capable of getting in your structural wood in the house. They basically have a one-way street from that firewood. And here's where, depending where you are in the state, people have differences of opinion. I mean, mine, as an entomologist, I tell folks you keep the wood outside where it stays cold and the insects are dormant. You bring a week or two supply and that's fine. You know, the people up in Ashland will tell me, you know, I have to store a year's worth of wood in my basement. And if that's the case, there could be critters coming out from it. And the problem there is that we can't spray for that. I mean, if you spray, it doesn't work. Plus, putting insecticide on a piece of firewood and throwing it in the fire, that's not a good thing to do.
That'd probably be worse for us than the insects.
Right. So, you know, sometimes you can get some effect by tarping the wood when it's outside and both kind of cooking it and drying it out to make it less susceptible to some of these insects. So that's something to consider.
Is that curing wood?
Yes.
Is that the term?
Okay. Yes. And then, I guess, finally, what we see in this week in particular with this warm-up that we're having is all these creatures that crawled into the attic or crawled into the walls to spend the winter last fall, the box elder bugs, the cluster flies, the Asian lady beetles, and I have a handful of other critters that will do this. It's finally warming up enough in the walls that they're active. And I've already started to see ants. And the particular thing there, they're carpenter ants. And the thing I always tell folks about carpenter ants in the winter, it verifies that the nest is indoors. And if you see it kind of going hot and cold, depending on the outside air temperature. So the sample I got this morning, I can tell somebody that the nest is away from an outside wall. It's been cold enough that you would think that the critical temperature is about 50 degrees. If the walls are 50 degrees or less, even if the ants are there, they couldn't move. By the ants being active right now, that suggests there's some place that's staying warm all the time. Versus these nests in the walls or the attic will probably wake up the end of February, beginning of March, when it's still way too early for outside ants to come in.
Right.
And as we always talk about on the show, we made a mistake by calling them carpenter ants because people have the vision that their house will be totally eaten up, and they don't eat wood. They just nest in bad wood.
Okay. So they're not, are they in the category of more of a nuisance than a real danger?
Yes. Okay. And when people do find structural damage, you can take a step back and say, you know, you've had a water problem for a long time, and the water and the rots and all that complication is really what the big factor is, not the ants.
So the ants just happen to be where the damage is because that's the
Well, they nest in rotten wood. And, yeah.
But they're not causing the, they're not causing it. We'll go back to more indoor insects, but since you just mentioned box elder bugs, Linda in Pewaukee seems to have some, so let's go there. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm kind of plagued with box elder bugs. My west-facing condo was covered with them this fall on warm, sunny days, hundreds of them, but they're still showing up in my residence in the cold weather. The other day, I got out of my favorite chair after having coffee. First thing in the morning, went back to sit down. There's a box elder bug. They've been on my bed. They're crawling across my living room floor. I have sprayed all my entrances with what's supposed to be a six-month bug repellent type product. I don't know where they're coming from and why would they be there in cold weather.
Okay, so basically, I hate to say this, but you lost the opportunity in the fall because the whole idea of box elder bugs is either to have things tight enough that they can't get in, or if that's not the case, you spray them before they get in. But once they work up underneath the siding, they go through roof vents and whatnot, they're not available any longer. And then when things warm up enough, they become active and they can squeeze through light plate fixtures and all kinds of things. So they're crawling out from your walls or your ceiling space. And honestly, spraying indoors doesn't get you very far. I mean, the chemicals, they may eventually kill them, but the idea here is even if they crawled across your door and were contacted, it might take them 4 or 5 hours to die. In that interim, they've still created a displeasurable experience for you, and I just don't see gaining. So in the future, when you see those clusters in the fall, that's when they need to be treated. And, you know, we've got some soapy water sprays or a similar spray to what you're using on the outside, then will give you a far more effective treatment. And it's kind of once you get into the 1st of November and such, I often suggest to folks, don't bother, as I said, other than sweeping them up and the like. And unfortunately, you're going to continue to see activity until probably April when they finally do move outdoors and leave you alone.
And am I remembering correctly, Phil, that 2012 was a really big year for box elders?
Yeah, hot, dry, I always think of. And that's a native insect, and it seems that there is a fungus that is quite common in controlling the population, but the fungus requires humidity and moisture. Mm-hmm. And so when you get dry years, they're kind of unchecked. And so I usually expect my worst years in. You know, this year, what's quite fascinating, and I set a record this year in the lab with number of samples, number of emails. I mean, it was as buggy as I've ever seen, part of it because it was such a long growing season. But there's evidence that box elder bugs went through an extra generation. I mean, it was
really?
A long enough growing season that rather than having two generations, I think we had probably a third from what I can see. So that, again, just gives them more opportunity to get their numbers up.
Now, they had a big year with the drought. Will that impact their numbers next year, either positively or negatively?
We start the spring high, but with insects, it's all going to be weather next year. So I really don't. It does not assume. If I knew the rainfall patterns of next year, I'd feel more comfortable. Although I did share with people back, I think it was 2009 when we had a relatively wet year. I was expecting a quiet box elder year, and Phil was wrong. they were far more prevalent than I would expect. I'm still confused about that one. I don't know what the explanation is.
You can't
is.
Retire until you figure that out, Phil.
Well, I'm on the other side of things, is that I've seen enough of this stuff where the bugs aren't reading the same books Phil is. I expect them to do something different. So as I said, it's both fascinating, but it also humbling might be the best way to put it.
I know people are not big fans of box elders, but do they cause damage? Are they just a pest
nuisance? I mean, in extreme cases, when you mess with them, they leave a little yellowish waste spot. And if I had a beautiful white curtain and I had a bunch of them, and you know, that could be a concern. Which is one of the arguments why I don't like chemicals, because they often go through various convulsions and whatnot. It's easier to get the shop vac up and just be done with them. They feed on the seeds of maples and box elder, and box elder is in the same genus as maples. And so, you know, in a seed-producing situation, which we don't do here, then it would be a pest. But any other case, I mean, some would argue if they're affecting the seed of box elder, that's good, because that's kind of a weedy tree. I mean, people aren't real happy with that. They're pretty much neutral at best. I think other than they can be a major nuisance. If you've never experienced a bad situation, it almost borders on science fiction. I mean, you can have them, a white wall can be totally black and orange because they're that common.
Wow.
And on the south side, a sunny exposure in the fall.
Wow. And of course, even more annoying when they set up. Yes. Housekeeping inside.
Any bugs, as I said, I know people's tolerance of critters coming in is pretty small, but the good news, I mean, there's no disease, they don't bite, they don't breed, you know, so as I said, it's just, they kind of get in your
way.
They're
just annoying. Well, thanks for that, Linda, and good luck maybe next season heading them off at the pass. Let's go to Brian in La Crosse next. Hi, Brian.
Thank you, Phil, for your information. You're fascinating to listen to. Last year, we had a infestation fields of a stink bug that was larger. It was brown gray. It was young. They ate the young plants, and then at the end of the season, they would literally cover the squash, thousands of them. And what about next year, or what will be the prognosis for them?
I picked up enough. So interesting enough, this year there is a squash bug which is related to stink bugs. It's a different family. And Phil was always under the assumption we had one common squash bug. And when people started sending me samples this year, honestly, I picked up three other species. One of them was a state record. It was one from the southeast part of the state called a citron bug. The other one was called an armored squash bug. The other one was called a horn squash bug. So I can tell you very easily, it was a great year for squash bugs. Now, the species that normally are here, I'm not worried about the one from the southeast because no matter how mild this winter is, it's too cold for them to get going. But these other ones overwinter as adults. And so here's a case where you could at least speculate that if it's a relatively mild winter and we've got some decent snow cover for insulation, we will start to spring with good numbers of squash bugs. But then, much like the box elder bug, it's more related to what's going on. And squash bugs in general are one of those critters that I never had that much exposure to early on, and they seem to be intensifying. But when I think of squash bugs, I think of Illinois. I mean, that's just so it's another one of these things that are moving upwards. And you know, when I checked our records in our museum about these two newer species that I had not been exposed to before, we had occasional records that, you know, some of our students that have been collecting in prairies have collected them and put them in the museum, but they really weren't that common. And so, as I said, I think there was something dynamic about this year, that the hot, dry was good for them, and some of these species were much higher than their normal populations.
And we were seeing unusual ones, but those may not.
Yeah, the one unusual one, the armored one, I think as I said, in the scheme of things, I'm sure it's always been there, but this is the first year I've seen them cause much of a problem. I'll tell you the other thing, though, is that these are so similar looking. I mean, the armored and the horned one are about a third smaller. And then again, under a microscope, they have a few things that caught my attention. But to the average person, they just look like a squash bug. So in the defense would be the same. You know, we tell people to be quite aggressive early in the spring. If you see any squash bugs getting on your young transplants, you want to slam the door there before they get a chance to breed. If you see the little kind of grayish green nymphs on your plants, they respond quite well to the soapy water sprays. Unfortunately, the adult squash bugs are a little bit more difficult to kill. They're a little bit thicker skinned, and that's what compromises the soap treatments.
Thanks for that call, Brian. And I want to go back to something you just said, Phil. You were talking about some of the squash bugs maybe overwintering right now under a snow cover. How do insects spend the winter outdoors? And, you know, are they hibernating, basically, or what are they
doing? It's a form of, we call it diapause. In insects, kind of use the same cues that plants do, that the shorter day length gets them to start changing their physiology to get prepared. And we've got insects that overwinter as cocoons, as eggs, and some as adults. And so insects have different strategies. And we got a whole bunch of critters that blow up here every year that don't even have the respect to spend the winter here. But normally they're going to look for some kind of shelter. Some fascinating work that my colleague, Dr. Groves, and his students did with Colorado potato beetle, which is a native insect. If they get out and put out some trash and litter, and that's what the adults like to crawl underneath, they go out there in January and pull the snow back. And then, of course, they're recording the temperatures. You kill these things at like 20 degrees. I mean, they're wimpy.
Mm-hmm.
But normally they don't get that exposure. As I said, they're well insulated and the like. And so it's quite interesting. And I often, when I look at the winter, I really don't find it having as much effect on insect populations unless we have crazy extremes. My crazy extreme is 30 below. Or a lot of icing or something else that really, again, causes all kinds of oxygen problems for the insect. What I see influence my insect populations more is spring weather. And it's the old story, if you wake them up early and get them active and then we get a snowfall or a frost, then that has the bigger impact. So I generally, in fact, I find it quite humorous last year as we were coming in the spring, there was all these people making predictions of how bad the ticks were going to be, how bad these other insects are going to be. And I'm thinking, where's the science there? And then when you go in to see who's promoting this, these weren't scientists. These are people that sell insecticides and the like. And so, and especially they made this generalization for the whole country and, of course, different weather patterns. And so I'm always leery. In fact, the tick one really got us going because, again, my colleague, Dr. Paskowitz, and I, we were sitting, I said, Susan, I just don't know of any data that would suggest the ticks are going to be bad just because it was a somewhat mild winter. And that was her same conversation, that it's just, you know, somebody's making that statement and it gets in USDA Today and all of a sudden it's gospel. So.
Well, and it's interesting because at least in the southern part of the state, we're going to have a pretty significant warm up now through even the beginning of next week. And I'm guessing a lot of our snow cover, if not all of it, is probably going to melt. If we then get some really cold temperatures without that snow, before another snow cover falls, that sounds like it could have an impact on our insects.
Frost depths, I mean, all those things come into play here. But, you know, this is not enough to wake too much up, although don't be surprised. I mean, today, I bet you if you went out in the woods, you potentially could see a couple butterflies flying because we have some that overwinter as adults and they kind of wake up. Yeah, so morning cloaks in particular are quite common in these funny warm-ups.
Wow.
Mosquitoes, as the person said, we have mosquitoes that overwinter in tree holes and other things. And I've had people had mosquito bites in January when they're out walking. Maybe it probably have to be more like 55 degrees. Yeah.
Well, we are talking with entomologist Phil Pelletieri about the wonderful world of insects, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about insects with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. He is the head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab and comes by just about once a month to tell us what's going on with the world of insects. And we had an email, Phil, from Sarah in Plymouth. She says, my parents have a bee tree on their farm in southwest Wisconsin. For many summers, we've watched them going in and out of a small hole in the trunk. On New Year's Eve, we noticed several frozen bees around the tree in the fresh snow. It hadn't been overly warm. Why would they have come out?
They may be sick. I mean, to be honest, it's quite common for bees to dispose of their sick members and whatnot. And, you know, the other thing is the concern about how long the colony can go. I mean, bees have natural ways of requeening and the like, but it's been fascinating to me that honeybees, you know, when we started getting the mite problems and other things coming on, that these feral or wild colonies almost totally disappeared. But there's a lot of evidence in the last 5 to 10 years, 5 years in particular, that these wild colonies are becoming more prevalent, which argues that the honeybees are adapting, or we're genetically selecting for ones that are hardier, that don't put up, have the mite problems and the like. And so for a while there, I'd never get honeybee complaints. Now I occasionally, because honeybee colonies can move into people's attics and whatnot, and it's different than the average wasp problem for two reasons. One, they're perpetual. They sustain themselves through the winter and the like, whereas our wasps completely die out and they start everything from scratch somewhere else the next year. So, but more problematic is if they store honey and comb and whatnot in the house, that poses both rotting problems, wildlife problems, and even if the bees are killed, if there's another swarm in the neighborhood, they're attracted to that. And so it comes back. You know, we think we solved the problem, and a year later, all of a sudden, we got bees.
It's like
in the
moving
attic
into
again.
A furnished apartment. It's all ready to go.
So,
wow. Well, that's really interesting. And actually, since you just mentioned wasps, Cookie in Milwaukee had a wasp question. So let's go there. Hi, Cookie.
Hi. Yeah, I have a tree stump in my backyard, and there were just a few, you know, wasps going in and out. But one day I was picking weeds out of my garden and I threw it in a big black garbage bag. And then I threw the bag closer to the garbage can, which was very close to that tree stump. And I sat down on my swing and I was reading, and all of a sudden I heard this ping, ping, ping. And I looked up and there were hundreds of wasps attacking this bag, this garbage bag.
Huh.
And so it was very scary, for one thing, because I was afraid, you know, that they were going to come after me if I moved. But do you know what was going on?
Well, the one thing that comes to mind is there's a whole bunch of things that are wasp and wasp relatives that are quite different than the average ones that we think about. And I'm a little bit, you know, I can't think of ground nesting wasps and whatnot, what the devil they would have an interest there. But sometimes when we see congregations of, you know, black and yellow striped critters, they turn out not to be wasps, but sawflies and other creatures. And so my first thing is it's got to, right away I would go to some form of mating, you know, if it's a lek or some other biological thing where we've got a bunch of males that are around and they're competing with each other and they're very aggressive. And so they give you the impression. And so my first take too is that very likely they're not even a stinging form of wasp. But that's a guess. Because as they said, I just can't think what yellow jackets or other ground nesting wasps would have. I mean, they'd have an interest in food, you know, so they scavenge on sugar and protein. But that would be a very different behavior than, as you say, them kind of banging into things, which, again, sounds more aggressive.
Right.
And then I go back to, I wonder if it was some kind of male territorial issue. And then the question is there's a bunch of things that look wasp-like that are not really true stinging wasps.
These were wasps.
Well, I have 100 things that look like wasps that aren't or are variations of. If you had a pitcher or had a critter, of course, that's not, I guess, to be expected. But that would be the only way I could verify what was going on. But I just can't think what a garbage bag full of weeds would have any kind of attractancy to them.
Unless they were feeling threatened by just something that size suddenly landing right next to their stump.
They get quite aggressive if there's vibrations and movement, but an inanimate object like that, I just can't see which would cause them to get aggressive.
Well, it's certainly an interesting experience, and good thing it was the black bag and not Cookie herself.
Yes, yes.
that would have been a whole different story. Well, actually, Pat in Green Bay also has a question about wasps, so let's go there. Hi, Pat.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Hey, Dr. Phil, you're just awesome. Let me tell you, I learned so much from you. I'm the guy, and I live in Sturgeon Bay, and I sent you a picture of my shop vac evacuation of a nest we had in the house this summer. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Oh, yeah. And that were, I couldn't believe how many of the, I believe they were wasps. Now, I can't remember because that, you know, it was a few months ago, but I kept, how many we sucked out of the house. It was incredible. Thousands of them.
Yeah. I mean, the colonies start, what's fascinating to me is those colonies started from a single queen in the spring, and those are all her daughters for the most part of the year, but then they do produce males in the fall of the year so that they can mate, and then those fertilized queens start everything from scratch the following year. And if you get in the late summer and the colonies are successful, you're exactly right. We're talking thousands of individuals. And the reason that they can't survive the winter, unlike honeybees, is they've got no food. And if they've got no food, there's no energy. If there's no energy, they can't produce heat, which is the exact why honeybees store honey, is that they literally...
It's energy.
Yeah, they literally buzz their wings all winter long to generate heat to keep the colony going. And, of course, there's this relationship. If they don't have enough food, they will die from the cold. Or the other side, if there's not enough bees in the colony, then they can't generate enough heat to survive. So those are a couple of variables that fit into that. But, you know, your treatment of using the shop vac, I do know not a lot of pest control firms use that, but that's a very interesting way of doing things. And, you know, basically everything that comes out of the opening can be captured. And so it's a very interesting and not very invasive type of treatment if you set up the right conditions. So, yeah, I enjoyed the picture, and it is a unique way. You might even consider opening up as a business.
There you go, a little sideline there.
No, thank you. It was sometimes I had that vacuum going for like 7 hours a day, and they just kept coming. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, and when we've talked before on the show, the problem that people can have sometimes when they have these colonies in a wall, I mean, the good news is most of the time you just wait until November and they die out on their own. So if they're not causing problems and we're late enough in the season, that's often, I think, the best solution. And there's no reason to open up the wall and go after things. Mm. But where we run into more problems is if people think that they're going to solve the problem by sealing the entrance, and then they literally find wasps coming through their light fixtures and every place else, and then they're in the house and they're not very happy. It's really best. The only time to seal up the openings is when we're sure that the critters are done. And then, indeed, we can seal it up to prevent the relatively small but possibility that a queen starts everything from scratch the next year in the same spot.
Wow. Well, thanks for that story, Pat, and thanks so much for listening. Let's go to Kathy in Lancaster next. Hi, Kathy.
I'm wondering, when is the best time to treat for clothes moths? I've got the traps and I've got the spray and I did my closet and never got anything in the trap. And now I've got obviously clothes moths in a different closet.
Okay, so the first question is, I mean, are you finding larvae on your wools or hair or silks? You're just finding holes, but you're not finding critters?
I guess I've seen it, like a few little dry things.
Okay, so I'm not convinced it's clothes moths. It turns out that we are seeing more clothes moths now than we used to, but there's two forms of clothes moths. There's a webbing clothes moth and a case-making clothes moth. In both cases, you get little white worms that make webbing. In the case of the case-making, it's almost a cigar-like structure that they make out of the fibers of what they're eating. So they're the same color as your sweater, which is kind of interesting. But there's a definitive piece of evidence next to the hole. The other thing about clothes moths is they only feed on natural fibers. So you can talk about mohair, wool, and silk. Any holes in cotton or other types of products can't be. And so those are more physical. Now, I will tell you the other thing that we see causing probably historically more problems are carpet beetle larvae, because they eat animal hair, they eat dead insects, all kinds of things, and everybody's got a few carpet beetle larvae in their house. But what I suggest for folks to consider as a way to combating those is they're far more likely to attack soiled goods than they are things that are clean, so that helps. They're far more likely to do the damage in the summer, both because the temperatures, and that's when they're more active, and that's, of course, when we're not wearing a lot of this stuff. So I think starting with a garment that has been cleaned, dry cleaned, washed, whatever, or at minimum taking the vacuum cleaner to it and just kind of going through all the nooks and crannies, taking that item and putting it in a tight-fitting plastic container so it's physically protected is all you need to do. No chemicals, no worry about anything there. Now, what I would suggest in your case is pay particular attention along the base of the closet floor, along the shelves where they meet the wall, and see if you see any kinds of little pieces of evidence, which basically are going to be the skins of the carpet beetles. They're little brownish things, to at least suggest that's what it is. But you know, going back to what's interesting about both clothes moths and carpet beetles, they don't like to attack things that are disturbed. So it's usually when they're in storage and put away. It's not in the winter when we're, you know, once a week pulling out the coat and the like. And then again, it's sometimes hard to diagnose when I put them under the microscope. But what I'm always looking for is evidence, you know, little pieces of insect waste, whatnot, to verify that it was insect related versus some other kind of physical problem. And in particular, you've taken the step of getting a clothes moth trap. If there were clothes moths in your house, they would be there. That trap is that sensitive. That would pick it up. Unfortunately, there are no good carpet beetle traps out there.
And so it sounds like the prevention is worth more than the cure.
Yes.
Well, and that's what I'm looking for. When should I put those traps out if it is indeed the clothes moth?
And we will get back to that after this quick look at the news from NPR. Insects are important players in a variety of ecosystems. They help control other insects' populations, plus they serve as pollinators and food for birds and other animals. But some can cause a lot of damage to homes and gardens if they're not controlled. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're lucky to have entomologist Phil Pelletieri here for the next half hour to talk about the fascinating world of insects. He's got lots of great information to share about the most common of insects as well as the rare ones. And he'll answer your questions, too. Is there an insect you want to know more about? Wonder what 2013 might bring in the insect world? Join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. And don't forget to check our Facebook page to post your comments and photos. Like the page while you're there to get updates on upcoming show topics and useful resources. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after the news with Phil. When you think of Wisconsin's wildlife, you probably think first of deer, wolves, and coyotes, or maybe bald eagles, sandhill cranes, and goldfinches. But in terms of both sheer numbers and numbers of species, they all pale in comparison to the insects that share our state with us. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. We're lucky to have entomologist Phil Pelletieri with us as our guide to the world of insects. He helps us figure out what we're dealing with and what to do. Phil, always great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
And we were just finishing up with a question about clothes moths from Kathy in Lancaster, when she should do those preventive measures.
I think the best time to get a trap out is kind of the late winter, early spring, because we see a lot of activity of the insects kind of transforming into adults. So if I had to pick the perfect time, that would be it. The other thing to keep in mind on those traps is that the lure that brings the males in starts to go bad over time. And so, you know, it depends on which one you get, but every 2 months to 6 months, that should be replaced. Because as I said, it kind of loses its punch.
Is it like a pheromone attraction?
Yes, it is a pheromone.
Okay.
Yeah. And, so, you know, for people that have got a lot of, taxidermy mounts and a lot of valuable, animal hair coats, it's probably cheap insurance because I'll guarantee you that the traps will pick up activity before you start to see damage.
And how many traps do you need?
Normally one or two in there. Normal house is more than enough.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't want people to get too paranoid about this because, I mean, clothes moths are prevalent in nature in bird nests and other things. So they're the kind of out there. What I have seen is an influx of clothes moth infested goods from South America and from Eastern Europe. So Oriental rugs. And again, I'll go back to my comment earlier about they like things that are undisturbed. And so things back in closets are far more likely. Or even for valuable oriental rugs, what we tend to see the damage is the part of the rug that's underneath the heavy couch that you never move. The place that you're normally vacuuming and get access to, they don't mess
or
with.
Or even
but
just
that
walking
little,
on.
Probably, little corner back that, you know, once every 2 years you move the couch to get after it. That's when you move the couch and you see the damage.
Wow. Interesting. Well, hopefully that's helpful, Kathy. And since we're talking about traps, I want to actually let me let people know that they can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question, comment, or an insect photo on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Phil, talking about traps for clothes moths, what about other traps that we might use inside the house? Are there traps that you particularly recommend or discourage the use of?
Well, one that I went in conversations with people that have problems, the most prevalent moth we get in the house is the Indian meal moth, which is a dry goods and pantry pest moth. And the real key to control is sanitation. You find the infested food, get rid of it, and you make sure that other things that they could get into are sealed well enough that they can't. What I find people get a little confused about is they say, well, I've got the moth traps and it's not helping me. Well, the moth traps only catch males. So they're a monitoring tool. But as far as a control technique, really the traps that are out there and the way that they're used are not. And so that's probably the main consideration too. Probably more fitting in warehouses and food storage areas where, again, we're trying to catch things before they get going. But indoors, they really, I don't think, for the average homeowner, give you that much help. And the other problem, maybe that they would help a little bit, is if you went through the cleanup, you gave it some time and you're still catching moths, what it tells you, you missed something.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll guarantee you, they'll let you know that down the road anyway. We have had this conversation in our own household. We brought Indian meal moths in and some birdseed out, and they had a great time there, and we fed the birdseed out. Well, then they got into the cupboards and got after our noodles and rice. We threw those goods out. We sealed things up. And where my credibility went down the tubes is I'd see one moth every 3 weeks. And so my wife, of course, was having lots of fun pointing out what a good entomologist I was. And it took me months to get this figured out. And what it finally traced to, and I share this with people because it's, you know, it's one of those things of how much of a detective it takes sometimes, is I had this little True Value hardware store bag sitting on my workbench that I knew there were screws in there. Well, it turns out the screws were a bunch of vegetable seeds my father-in-law had given me. So once I saw what the food substrate was, it made sense. That's right. Where the Indian meal moths were. But I just wasn't looking there because it wasn't obvious that that would have been a food base that would get them going. And, of course, not a whole lot of seeds, so not a whole lot of moths. But
just
until
enough.
I found that, there was one trickling through. And as I said, so I and that's what I guess over the years I've enjoyed with talking with folks is that you kind of build up this experience situation where you can share with people, well, if this doesn't work, just
you have a whole toolbox.
And one other one that I've run into a number of cases with this is that if people have had mouse problems in the house and the mice have stole cat food or dog food and stashed them in the walls, that's sometimes the source of some of these grain-based pests.
Wow. And we had a caller who asked where to get the carpet bug traps and a little more on how to use them.
If you're really getting into a company that specializes in traps and in monitoring, there's a company called Insects Limited, and they're located in Indiana. And they sell mass quantities. I mean, they sell things to museums and grain facilities and whatnot, but they do have packaging for. And the thing about them is that this is the company that makes the pheromones and puts these traps together. I've seen some other things that I've seen at the hardware store once in a while that I think are very misleading in their packaging and whatnot and in what they really do attain. So they said, if I had to send somebody to a site, the Insects Limited site, some good educational information there too, you know, what some of these things look like, what to expect. And although the focus of that company, and they also get into fumigation, is more for dealing with large infestations, there's some good information for homeowners there.
And I'll make sure that link gets up later on the Facebook page also. And speaking of pantry moths, Tom in Kingston had a question. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Your guest pretty much answered all the questions. I've had them for maybe 3 years, and I've got those pheromones, little square or little triangle deals. I got 50 of them all over my house, but after 3 years, I've pretty much limited them. Just like your guest said, once in a while, every week or so, you see one flying around. So I'm getting to the point to think that I'm never ever going to eliminate them completely. But he pretty much answered all the questions. But when I just heard you talking about mouse, I've put in my house, I've got all these electronic noisemakers now, and I think it's really helped my mouse situation. What did your guests feel about those?
Well, that's really Dr. Craven's area. What I know of the science is the science doesn't support they work.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Craven and I have been on programs together, and we've discussed it. The same thing for insects, because they sell some of these sonic devices that are supposed to repel insects. And there's just very little evidence that they behave in the way that these people suggest.
Mm-hmm. And going along with the question that Tom had about pantry moths, are they... Are pantry moths a disease issue or just
not
a
at
pest?
All? And even if you were ingesting them, you know, there's no evidence that there's any complication there. But they're quite a nuisance, and they're frustrating from the fact that, you know, a glued cardboard box of pancake batter is not immune from it. I mean, there's a lot of packaging they can get into that is not substantial enough. And so again, and the other thing is that anything that's plant-based supports them. So I see them in potpourri. I see them in dried flower arrangements. I see them in Christmas wreaths made out of walnuts. I mean, when you take a step back, it's pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But at first you're thinking, well, it's got to be a box of cereal. And more often it's these things that are stored away somewhere else. And what is helpful sometimes is you expect, for the most part, that the highest density of moths will be close to the source. So when somebody says it's in their bedroom, again, I'm not worrying about the cupboard. I'm worrying, what do you have stored in your closets that would be a food substrate? Mm.
Thanks for that call, Tom. And we had a question on Facebook from Bill. If a mosquito is overwintering in a wood pile, is it likely to be male, female, or is there no likelihood of either gender being more common?
Depends on the species, but as a whole, most of our mosquitoes don't overwinter as adults, but the genus Culex does, and it's most likely to be a female.
All right.
Which is an interesting, this is West Nile story, plays into this, the virus overwinters in the gut tract of the mosquito, and then it starts feeding on birds and builds up mm-hmm. over the summer. And so there's some interesting things. But that's not the dominant biting mosquito here. It's the ones that bite us are the floodwater mosquitoes that are eggs in the snow right now. So
All right. Let's go back to the phones, and Dan is calling from Michigan. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a question about the brown recluse spider. There's a lot of speculation here. We get in the pest control industry, we get calls from clients and folks that fear they've gotten bitten by brown recluse, or supposedly were turned to us by their family doctor that said they were bitten by brown recluse. Now, I've never personally gotten a sample of it, mm-hmm. and that's the very hard part, is actually getting a sample of the spider specimen from these clients. Have you seen an increase in calls or fear of the brown recluse with the lighter winters here in the Midwest?
Well, the interesting thing is that I have seen in my whole career probably about 20 samples of brown recluse spider, and they are a little bit more frequent now than they have been. But the interesting thing when you get into more of this, I hear about the diagnosis of the bites a dozen or two dozen times a year. And it turns out that now the strong evidence is a lot of these cases were not spider bites at all, but were staph infections, mm-hmm. The MRSA staph, because it presents as an ulceration. And so a doctor's diagnosis, they're giving you their best educated guess, but until we find the spider. And what's interesting is in all the cases that I've had spiders come in, nobody's been getting bit. They just found a recluse spider that, you know, came in from a shipment from Kansas. Or I do have breeding populations in an apartment in Ripon, Wisconsin, about two or three sites, at least in Madison, but they never go anywhere. And so, you know, the bad part of this is there's a lot of misinformation on the internet, some incredible pictures at times, horrific of complications. And what's interesting is you start doing some investigation, there is very little evidence, because this shows up, the same bite showed up in 10 different states on the same person. Well, they didn't live in 10 different states. It's, again, people keep posting these things. In order to get some clarification, there's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Rick Vetter that's at the California Riverside who has published extensively on recluse. And he's finally gotten enough stuff in the medical journals that I'm finding the doctors are starting to understand that even though you're taught in medical school that if somebody comes in with an ulcerated bite on their arm, that it's probably recluse, what got Rick interest in this is half the cases got diagnosed in states where the spider's not found. And that's, of course, what led us to look at that there was something wrong mm-hmm. with that story. So, again, with you being in Michigan, you have a similar story to Wisconsin. Recluse is extremely rare. In fact, Rick does not consider them established in Wisconsin. Even though I know we've got these isolated breeding populations, the normal range is central Illinois south. And as I said, in most cases, what the speculation is that these are bacterial infections that present. Now, the interesting question is, could those be spider bites that are bacterial infections? They could be, but they could also be scratches and a whole bunch of other things. And so spiders get blamed for a whole heck of a lot that they're not responsible for, is what we seem to find.
I was going to say, Phil, that I think it's a rare show that you're on that we don't have people asking about spider bites, and you saying that, yeah, unless you actually see a spider biting you, which is pretty rare already, right, there's a good chance that it was not a spider.
And the other problem is we've got a bunch of spiders that look rather similar. I mean, some of the sac spiders and whatnot are the same shape, color, size. But, you know, the distinguishing thing for me is that brown recluse only has six eyes, which most of the spiders we have in our country have eight eyes. And so if I can get a good look at them. And the second thing is they have a very distinct violin dark marking on their cephalothorax. And it takes no imagination to see the neck and the whole body of the violin. Whereas if there are stripes or spots or other kinds of markings, it turns out to be a spider that we're not concerned about.
All right. Thanks for that, Dan. And let's go next to Steve in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. Or afternoon, I guess. Phil, I'm wondering, you probably answered this question a million times before, but I can't remember what I had for breakfast, say nothing about what you said last month. So could you tell me what might be a good book to help me identify the various bugs that we might see in southern Wisconsin or Wisconsin as a whole?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I do a lot of lecturing to master gardeners and the like. And in the one book that I'm the most fond of, and this has more to do with what you would find in your backyard, is the book called Garden Insects of North America by Whitney Cranshaw. And Whitney has a lot of insects that you would expect to find on your viburnum bushes and your lilacs and whatnot, which are, again, the kind of things people would bump into. He does have pictures of beneficial insects and spiders and whatnot. So he really tried to do a pretty broad picture. But if you were, you know, normally out in the woods and seeing all kinds of strange things because you're in a different environment than somebody's backyard, that probably would not be the book. But I'm not so sure I can think of one that would cover that. It's this diversity thing that we've got, you know, with 25,000 species, you know. There's just so many crazy oddball things that you could run into. And I just don't know a book that picks that kind of stuff up as much. But I think as a reference, I find Whitney's book to be broad enough based. If you're a gardener, a naturalist or whatnot, that would be the book I would invest in. Lots of pictures. And to be honest,
it's a gorgeous book.
It's only, you know, $22, $23 on Amazon. So it's not a large investment. Now, if you get more specialized, we're seeing more and more books come out, the damselflies of the North Woods and those kind of things, where they are taking a particular group of insects, giving you a very detailed treatise. If we had that for all the insects that are out there, we'd be in great shape. But it's probably the more popular things, the butterflies, the moths, the damsel and dragonflies. And there's a couple beetle books out there that are reasonable, but there's so many species of beetles that they even don't give that probably the just due that they need.
And that book, The Garden Insects of North America, you had recommended that, and we used it as a pledge premium a couple pledge drives ago. And I'll make sure that a link for that gets up on the Facebook page. I've got a lot of work to do after the show. Lots of good resources that we'll make sure are available. Let's go to Chuck in Oregon next. Hi, Chuck.
Hi there. I've got a cockroach problem in my apartment. They've been there for a couple months. And we've tried different things. Our apartment manager's had a guy come in to spray for him twice. I don't know what he used. And we've been putting down a boric acid solution or mixture, and it's just really not doing any good.
Do you know if it's German cockroaches, brown banded, or somebody else?
I really don't know.
Big cockroaches or kind of small?
Up to an inch in size.
Okay, so probably the most prevalent one is German cockroach. And so one of the questions is there other apartments that have been treated, or don't you know?
Yeah, we think our apartment manager said he thinks they came from the apartment below us. They left a big mess there last year, and so.
Okay. Well, you know, cockroach control has gotten somewhat easier because one of the techniques that is being used are very specific baits that are made. And boric acid is effective, but the problem is you got to get it in the roach. And it's done one of two ways. It's put into a food substrate that they like, which is usually kind of peanut butter or similar based. Or if you dust a wall with boric acid, when the cockroach walks through the dust, as long as there's no water, because that will wash it away, the little crystals of boric acid get on their legs, and when they clean themselves, that's how it gets in their stomach. So boric acid has been a successful tool. It takes a little time to kick in. But my first thing is, if somebody's been wrestling with this for 2 months and it isn't getting a whole lot better, something is not matching right. I don't know if they're not spraying the right areas, they're not using the right product, but you should be able to get some response. But then you go back to why I was asking the questions about neighbors, is if the main source is somewhere else and that's not being treated, all you're doing is getting them constantly immigrating in. So somebody's got to do a little bit more detective work here. And, you know, I think you often found with the pest control people, it's well worth calling them up and just asking them, saying, you know, I'm having problems, you know, things aren't presenting correctly, or talk to the landlord, because, you know, in rental units, it's his responsibility. And a good technician will usually give you feedback. You know, in some cases, you know, they'll often require that the tenant cooperates, you know, get the dishes out of the cupboards and whatnot. And sometimes, you know, there are situations where things get so trashy and whatnot, and if they don't cooperate, it won't work. So not so much your place, but I'm a little nervous about your next door neighbor's apartment as being the reason that we see this, because as
they
said,
they just hang out there.
Cockroaches have gotten. It used to be we had some resistance problems, but now we've got so many more tools, and I'm just not seeing them to be quite the challenge that they were 10 or 15 years ago.
So it seems like there's something.
Yeah, there's something, a piece missing.
Yeah,
here.
Piece missing in the solution. All right, well, good luck with that, Chuck. And Sandy in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, I have flies. I've got gazillions of flies. It's like living in a really bad science fiction movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have a cat. So the spring has been not great, but I'm sure I'm poisoning both of us. The flies seem to enjoy this spray.
Okay, I'd stop spraying. And what's tough for me to answer, I really need to see the flies because there's so many different species. And it's kind of, if you know who you got, you can point to where the fire is coming from. And in some cases, you know, if it's a drain or something like that, or if these are cluster flies and they snuck in the fall, there's so many different scenarios. And so I'm not even sure the flies are breeding there versus they are flies that snuck in the fall. So I'd be happy to take a look. And you can't describe flies well enough for me. Flies are kind of difficult to identify. But yes. There are literally hundreds of different flies. And even things that look like house flies, I got six or seven things that aren't house flies that look like house flies. So with flies, I need to see samples. So you can bring them into the Milwaukee County Extension Office, and they will mail them in. Or some cases, the people there might even be able to identify them. It just depends what the kind of fly is. Or you can send them to my diagnostic lab, which you just send it to the insect lab. The address is 1630 1630 Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N Drive, Madison. The zip is 53706. And the one caution is with flies, I kind of need them intact. So if you just put them in an envelope and they're not cushioned, and I will get a fly pancake and I won't be able to do anything with it. But, you know, so somehow put it in a container that will be able to get through the mails where the flies are still somewhat intact. Definitely don't need to be alive. I mean, dead flies are just fine, but I need to have as close to a whole fly to work with, because I have to look at the bristles on their body and a few other things to tell what it is.
I wonder if it, like a discarded pill bottle or something would be
Quite common, to be honest. So I know what everybody's prescriptions are. But
take the labels off.
Yeah, take the labels off. But yeah, some kind of container that is substantial enough that it won't get crushed is the best. And as I said, then I think we'll be able to point you in a direction, because if the problem was breeding in front of you, then you'd spray it and it'd go away, but you'd see that and then you could clean it up. So as I said, there's a little bit more going on here, and if I knew what the fly is, at least I think I could point you in the right direction.
Good luck with that, Sandy. And that's a great reminder, Phil, that not only can people send the samples directly to you, and again, let's give that address. It's the Insect Diagnostic Lab, 1630 Linden Drive, L-I-N-D-E-N Drive. That's Madison, and the zip is 53706, and again, not completely squished, as intact as
hopefully
possible.
Yes.
But also, you know, we do have extension offices in every one of the 72 counties, and those are a great resource.
Yes. And what happens now is a lot of the offices have good enough digital equipment that they don't even send it to me. They can take a detailed enough picture. I can work from that. And this past year, 60% of what I processed in the lab were digital images, which, you know, is just mind-boggling to me, because it used to be everything was in a pill bottle. But
yeah. Well, at least you weren't up to your elbows in bugs.
Well, we still have that.
Still quite a few. Phil Pelletieri is an entomologist and the head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Phil, as always, it was a lot of fun.
Nice to be here.
And I hope you'll stay tuned. Tomorrow at 11, Chad Spate of Chad's Carpentry and Chaz Vaughn of the Window Design Center are here to talk about ice dams, condensation, and other winter house woes. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening.